Make of thyselves that which he desire. Be it a lord, be it a god.
Hello and welcome to Hey Lesson, the podcast where we underhandedly teach you things by talking to smart folks about silly video games. I'm your host, Brendan Caldwell, and today we are talking about Elden Ring, the new RPG made by Dark Souls developers From Software. It is set in a fantasy world, and if you've heard anything about it, you might have heard that Game of Thrones writer George R.R. Martin was involved in the world building for this game. But what the hell does world building mean? We don't know. So to answer that question, we're going to be speaking to a games writer who will tell us all about the process of creating fictional realms and why world building is not necessarily a magical solution to all your writing needs. That's coming up in just a couple of minutes. First, though, we always have a guest co-host on the show, and this time it is games journalist Ed Thorne. Hi, Ed.
Hello.
How's it going?
It's good. I'm happy to be here, and thanks for having me on.
For anyone who doesn't recognize your voice, can you let them know who are you? Where did you come from? Where did you come from? How do I know you?
Oh God. Yeah. So I'm a writer on rockpapershotgun.com.
No.
Yeah. I'm. You've clawed me away from that site for a little bit. And I just write about video games, reviews and features and things like that. And yeah, I have I like Souls games. So that's a positive for this podcast, I think.
So what you're saying is we have to focus entirely on Elden Ring.
Yes.
I'm not allowed to ask you, like, do you have any pets?
I've never had a pet. The closest thing I've had to a pet is a triop. I don't know if you've heard of triops before.
Is it an insect?
It's like a prehistoric little swimming thing that like buries itself, its eggs in like sand and like swims around.
Is it like a lizard?
It's not like a lizard.
What classification of animal is it?
I don't know how to describe it, but it's maybe sort of closest to like a crab with like a long tail, no pincers, and it's got lots of little legs underneath its shell. And she can basically like keep it in, I don't know, like a plastic container with water in, and it will just swim about, and it will just crack on, living its sort of prehistoric life.
What you're telling me is that you essentially kept a Dark Souls creature as a pet at one point.
Yeah, at the time, I wasn't even aware of Dark Souls, so clearly it's been bubbling up for years inside of me, this yearning for sort of eldritch creatures and keeping them as pets.
This might seem stupid because Elden Ring is one of the most anticipated games in years, but for anyone who doesn't care enough to watch E3 trailers or maybe has never been interested in Dark Souls, doesn't give a fig, can you tell us what is Elden Ring?
So Elden Ring, I would say, is an action RPG which takes place in a ruined world called The Lands Between. I guess just a quick sort of story, non-spoilery overview of it. There is this thing called the Elden Ring, or the titular Elden Ring, and it's been shattered for whatever reason. And those shards have kind of flung across this Lands Between, and they're now in the hands of some offspring of some god, and they're kind of clinging on to these shards. It's corrupting them with dark power, and you are this kind of, I don't know, a guy called a Tarnished, I guess, who's appeared in the Lands Between for whatever reason. You've got to get those shards, restore the ring, and I don't know what else, but that's the main aim, I guess, to reclaim the kingdom of the Lands Between. And you do so by adventuring around, trotting around on a spectral horse, fighting enemies and clearing dungeons and picking fruit and
picking fruit. I wasn't expecting that one, to be honest.
Yeah, I was gonna say, and gritting your teeth in pain at times, because if you've not played a Dark Souls game before, or well, a Souls game before, and this falls under that umbrella, they are sort of notoriously difficult and challenging, and this is the same. It's going to sort of require a lot of patience from you.
Before we go deeper into that world of Elden Ring, I wanted to know how such a world might be built. What does a writer of such worlds actually think about the process of world building, and how is it actually done? So to find out, I spoke to John Ingold of Inkle Studios, the creator of games like Heaven's Vault, which we've previously covered on the show. He has invented his fair share of fictional worlds, so here's what John had to tell us. Could you introduce yourself? Who are you and what do you do for a living?
Hi, I'm John Ingold, and I'm the narrative director of Inkle, which is a small independent games company from the UK. We've been going about 10 years now, which feels like forever, and we specialise in narrative games. So being the narrative director, I do most of the narrative design and almost all of the writing in the games that we make, which tends to be quite a lot of writing.
We are talking about Elden Ring in this month's episode. Game of Thrones author George R.R. Martin has been involved in the writing of that, and people who read a lot of fantasy or play a lot of fantasy games will have heard this term that we're going to talk about, which is world building. It's pretty straightforward, but for anyone who maybe doesn't go deep into the fiction side of things, could you tell us as a writer, what is world building?
So world building is usually used less by writers and more by readers to describe what they think the writer has done. It sort of means the creation of an unreal place with enough depth and detail that you can treat it as a real place that exists beyond the confine of the particular plot or story that you're telling. So there's this sense that writers have to do what Tolkien did and go away and produce an entire universe before they're allowed to produce a story in that universe. And that process is called world building. Though I think the reality is that writers vary massively in how much they actually bother to do that and how much they kind of construct it after the fact or in demand whenever they need it. They do just in time world building. If they need something, they very quickly cook it up before the reader gets there. But people believe this thing called world building exists, and perhaps it does.
Is it in any way useful to you as a writer to think, oh, I've got to do some world building now? Or is that a kind of waste of time?
It's a very attractive prospect to sit down at your desk and say, I'm now going to invent the recipes of a southern continent that doesn't exist. It's going to take me 3 days, and at the end of which I will have written not a single word. Because, you know, that way you can feel you're being productive when actually you're staring out the window. The reality is that you do have to do some world building. You do have to take decisions about what your world is going to be like, and they are pretty critical and they do affect everything else that comes afterwards. So, you know, I can't dismiss it completely as an activity, but I think, like a lot of writing, it's very rare to be in a position where you can do just world building. You always have to be thinking about the actual story you want to tell, or the characters you want to talk about, or the themes you want to talk about, or something else which constrains and shapes the world that you build by necessity for whatever it is you're building it for. It's very rare to be able to produce a world which is just a world and deliver it in any meaningful way.
Why is that? Is it because if you give just a world to someone, they wouldn't know what to do with it necessarily?
Yeah, absolutely. And like, a world is full of arbitrary decisions, ultimately. It doesn't really matter what kind of spaceships they use in Star Wars, and it doesn't really matter how the warp drive works in Star Trek, unless there's a story which actually impinges on those details, unless there's a character who likes one kind of spacecraft and not another kind of spacecraft. All those decisions can be swapped at any given moment. So I think the thing that's curious about it is people, when they like a fantasy setting, they do buy into it and believe it to be a holistic and created place. But generally speaking, for the writer, what they see are all the bits they haven't made their mind up about yet. And all the bits of the world which are still in the quantum flux state because they haven't been observed, and so they don't actually exist. The real reason that no one delivers a complete package world is that you don't want to write something down that you regret later on when it turns out it's not nearly as useful as the other thing you could have done.
So if you made a warp engine that functions in one way and then you need it in episode 19 of the latest Star Trek series to work another way, it can't because you've made the rules.
Yeah, exactly. Though, I mean, the writers of Star Trek deal with that with aplomb in virtually every episode of the program, where they say, oh, no, this week there's a quasma banging radiation, which means our teleporter won't work, so we can carry on with the plot as intended. But yeah, absolutely. You don't want to write yourself into a corner when you don't have to. And so I think most writers don't build any more of the world than they need to at any given time. I'm sure some writers do, because I'm sure, yeah, there are different kind of writers and every writer is different. But I think it seems to me that it's rare for people to really sit down and build a world in all of its details without having an inkling of the plot they want to hang off this stuff.
So do you think world building is more of a buzzword or an idea that exists in the mind of a reader than is a sought after skill for writers?
Yeah, I really do. I can't imagine how you would assess someone's skill at world building. Like, there are some basic things that a world should have, right? It should have more depth than you think it has as a reader. Like, it's always nice when you can see that the materials that somebody's using in a world make sense and you can imagine where they actually got them from, just as an example. But a lot of that is really about maintaining the suspension of the disbelief of the reader for as long as you possibly can by being just a little bit ahead of them. But I mean, how would you decide if someone was good at that or not? Like, if you're taken out of the context of an actual story or an event or a character, it's very hard to gauge whether this world is good or whether it's not good. I mean, a lot of the time when we look at bad world building, what we're really seeing is world building which feels derivative or familiar, and good world building is much harder to spot.
What about you? How do you go about creating a world in fiction, or is it something that happens naturally and not consciously?
No, it definitely does take conscious effort. But I think, like a lot of narrative work, it's about solving a problem which you encounter from multiple ends. So, you know, when we were building the world of Heaven's Vault, we had a visual style that we wanted to hit, and we had some thematic ideas that we wanted to include, and we had our character, who was an archaeologist, so this had to be a world with a long, complicated, repeatedly buried history, because otherwise, what does your archaeologist have to do? We wanted to include a robot, because I can't even remember why, but we wanted to. So it had to be a world with robots in it. so you kind of take all of those different things and you sort of poke them inwards to see how they meet in interesting ways and how do they set up interesting tensions and where are the possibilities for creating gaps in the player's knowledge or gaps in the protagonist's knowledge, which you can fill in interesting ways or you can exploit in interesting ways. And that gets you a little bit of the way towards building a world, but it's never done, right? So there's always a dance going on at that point. You start writing some content and you think, at this point, I really need to know what kind of food they eat on this planet. And I better decide that before the player walks into the room that's full of it. I need to know early, because so long as I'm one or two steps ahead of the reader, I can make it look seamless. Whereas if I'm a step behind, then I'm retconning and I'm in big trouble. So I tend to think of world building as just another one of the balls that you have to keep up in the air as you're building out your narrative. In the same way that I might think about characters, like when you're adding characters to a story, you want to make sure that you're not adding the same person again who you've already met. You have to make sure that it's a new character and that it will do interesting things to put this character next to the other characters.
There's something that I've heard, a thing the studios often have, which is something they might call a lore bible. Do you do anything similar to that at Inkle? And if so, what is that lore bible?
I think a lore bible is definitely a necessary tool if you have a writing team that's large and distributed and working over time. Because your readership, if they like your stuff, they're going to make one of those lore bibles in their own head. So you need to be, again, ahead of them. You need to be aware of what they're aware of. Otherwise, you can't interact with your readership. At Inkle, we have a slightly unusual setup in that we basically have one writer. Hello, it's me. So I don't tend to use lore bibles because either I have it in my head or I can change it. I think for Heaven's Vault, there was enough stuff that I wrote down a timeline at one point, and I had a list of things, beats I wanted to hit and ideas I wanted to include. But a lot of it otherwise was in flux if I needed it to be, and was just obvious if it was decided upon. It didn't need to be written down. I would never create a lore bible for myself because I don't need it for myself. It's almost counterproductive in a way. I think because once you start writing down the lore of the world, you move away from the character exploring the world and the player in a game exploring the world. And you might start building elements of your world that don't have any place in a story, in which case it's a waste of time.
in a bigger studio, I don't know if you've worked in other studios or anything, but what might a lore Bible actually look like? Is it a physical manual of paper people are handed, or is it just a big Google Doc?
Well, I mean, those two things are basically the same thing, right? But yeah, ultimately, a lore Bible in a large studio is going to be an extremely long Google Doc that gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And I can imagine being a new hire towards the tail end of a big project. The first thing you do in your week is read the 5,000-page lore Bible, which details absolutely every random idea that every writer has had and managed to shoehorn into this project at that point. And there are people whose, you know, jobs... Probably not their full-time jobs, but one of their core jobs is maintaining that lore Bible and making sure that it is consistent between all the various people working on it. And you can really see when that kind of level of craft has been applied to like a TV show or a game, which are very collaboratively written things. But it's still somehow in its heart a kind of project management tool rather than some wonderful creative tool. It's a way of sharing information between the human beings writing the project. It's not necessarily an interesting object of itself, though I bet the people who manage lore Bibles and love doing that job would argue with that.
How would it necessarily work? Does the art team need to flick through the index of a lore Bible to see what clothes a particular character would wear or what a certain type of sword might be made of? Is it that deep or...
Yeah, it probably is. I mean, it depends on the project, obviously, because a lot of the time in a game studio, the art team will design that stuff first, purely based on what's cool, and then the lore Bible people will have to go away and somehow make it make sense. So I can totally imagine, I don't know, but I can imagine that on Horizon Zero Dawn, they drew the robot dinosaurs before they worked out what they were made of and how those objects existed in the world, because that was the target they wanted to hit, and they wanted that to come first in the creation process. But generally speaking, a lore Bible does have to be agreed on by everybody involved. You can't have the costume designers going off and designing things that don't make sense with that lore Bible, even though they may well skim read it because they probably don't care what kind of fish they cook on this particular corner of the world. I remember, again, when we were making Heaven's Vault, I said we didn't have a lore Bible, but the one thing we did have was an architectural Bible, which was made by our lead environment artist, Laura Dilloway. And it was one of the first things she did, where she plotted out the various ages of the nebula and the way that building styles changed from period to period. So you can see the evolution in the shape of doorways in the game from site to site. And you can actually date which part of the history a particular location comes from by looking at its doorways and its windows. And I guess that is part of a lore Bible. It was a very specific usage for a lore Bible, but that was definitely Bibling.
That's interesting even to note that it's not just writers who are doing world building, if world building is a thing. It's your environment artists as well and other people.
Yeah, and I think it's worth thinking of world building almost as a continuity problem as much as it is a creativity problem, that you're trying to push the ceiling of your world by making it full of interesting and dynamic and fascinating things that the player is going to be excited to discover about. But you also need to keep checking the floor of your game. Like, does it make sense? Does it hang together? Is it coherent? Is it weird? Because we definitely notice it as audiences when elements are added to something which don't work. So in the Indiana Jones franchise, in the fourth film, they added some aliens, and that doesn't work with the rest of the lore of Indiana Jones. And that's why it sticks out and it feels wrong. And Star Wars, which is a huge sprawling thing that must have a lore Bible that's 100 pages long, if it's anything. But even there, they occasionally add elements that are divisive or that people don't feel quite fit within that franchise. Like the casino in The Last Jedi, which was very divisive. And
I liked the casino.
I liked the casino too, but a lot of people were like, what, I'm watching a completely different movie now. And I totally see where they're coming from. And arguably, Star Wars as a franchise does well when it experiments with its boundaries to work out where they are. But it's definitely part of the world building job is to check the consistency of new elements as they go in against everything else and say, does this tonally work within what we're doing? And it's not even necessarily, does it logically work? It can just be, is this thematically the right thing to add? You know, Star Wars monsters are always these big gloopy tentacly things. Would it make sense to add a monster that was like something out of an alien movie? Well, not really, actually. It would be tonally wrong because it's not Sunday afternoon fare.
Yeah, I don't want a type of Sarlacc that implants a chest buster in you.
Yeah, exactly. But why not, right? The universe is massive. That's a perfectly reasonable thing to appear on one of these planets. But that's, it's not a real universe. It's a made-up universe. And so it has other constraints which it has to satisfy if it's going to work.
What would you say to someone who's getting into writing and doesn't matter for what, and they feel like they've got to do some world building first? Do you think it's wise for them to start with world building, or do you think that they should do something else?
It's difficult to say if you're starting out, because if you're starting out, you've got to start somewhere, right? Some world building is better than no world building, definitely, because that way you can make sure that your world and your setting has something unique and special about it, something that doesn't mean that everyone's going to dismiss it as just a copy of something they've seen before. But I think the advice that I would give to anyone who hadn't already found their own way to handle this stuff, or the advice that I use myself to myself, is to stay two steps ahead of the reader, but never three. So do some world building, but do just enough that you can write the next bit and the bit that comes after it and know what the next bit is going to be after that. But don't go any further than that. You can work that out when you get there. So you should always be able to see just to the horizon, but you don't need to know what's over the horizon, because if the plot and the characters are moving forwards, the time will come when you'll need to figure that out, rather than feeling you need to get all of the world building done in advance before you can start writing anything, because that's procrastination.
John Ingold, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, that was John Ingold of Inkle Studios. That chat, as usual, is much longer than the 15-minute segment you just heard. We talked about more afterwards. So if you want to hear about how branching narrative fits into the process of world building, for example, that's something that happens in a lot of Inkle games, then you can get a longer version of our chat by becoming a patron. It costs as little as a couple of dollars a month. Just head to patreon.com/heylesson or click the link in the episode description. We don't have any ads. I don't have any sausages to sell you, or bed sheets, or I don't know what people sell on podcasts, Viagra. I don't have any of that. So you're really helping us out if you just support the patron. Ed.
I try not to laugh so hard throughout that.
You did a good job. You did a good job. Thank you. I did warn you that yeah. I have to do an advert to you live.
Yeah, I just didn't expect it to be so jarring, particularly the Viagra part.
I don't usually mention, blue pharmaceutical pills. All right,
I'm just trying to compose myself. Sort of the minds has got to sort of just eject that advert I've listened to and plug in some Elden Ring stuff.
Plug in Elden Ring.
Yeah, okay.
You mentioned the story before about how a ring has shattered, there are shards everywhere, there's lore going on, or, you know, everywhere. Does the story go any deeper than what you've told us? Or is it very, like, thin?
I would say a sort of that, in all honesty, I don't really have a clue what's going on, and that is for all that chatting about world building that you just listened to of John and everything like that, I've come to you and I've just said that I don't know what's going on, but I think that's the case with a lot of these Souls games. I'll play them and people will say stuff like King Gosmo of Blortron has taken my leather belt away from me and my pants have fallen down. You must retrieve this from my kingdom over here. And you're like, okay, cool. And that's deep and meaningful. Like in those games. And you've just got to accept that the NPCs will just say stuff to you. And it will become meaningful as you play, kind of as you adventure and as you explore, you'll kind of encounter environmental cues and NPCs or maybe bosses will just say stuff. Maybe when you die or if you kill them, that will kind of just unravel or like peel back just a little bit more on what's kind of going on. So I guess there is kind of like this deep sort of groundwork of lore, but they're kind of just drip feeding it to you over little bits of dialogue and churches you find and caverns you explore and things like that. So I think although I don't know what's going on, I'm like less frustrated by it and more just, I'm like incredibly curious. Like, I feel like I will kind of piece things together the more I play, because I have played a hell of a lot, but maybe not enough to quite, well, clearly not enough to fully understand what's going on, I think.
So on a scale of like obtuse Dark Souls 1 lore about the furtive pygmy to Sekiro style story cinematics, where does Elden Ring fall?
I would say it's not as obtuse as Dark Souls, but I wouldn't say it's as overt as Sekiro. So probably we're almost at Sekiro, I would say. We're almost there. There are times where it is quite not obvious, but NPCs will just explain bits to you. There's this kind of overarching theme in Elden Ring of like of limbs and kind of grafting limbs onto people. Items, for example, in the world, there's literally like fingers that you can get. Some of the bosses that have been shown off in the trailers, they have kind of arms attached to them and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And I think that there was certainly an NPC that I encountered quite early on that explained kind of her relationship to grafting, and that some of her men had been taken away to be grafted. And it was all really horrible and nasty, but it kind of, I don't know, a little light bulb went off in my head. And I was like, okay, so you've been dropping hints about limbs and people, limbs being taken away, but you've actually just told me now that this is a thing that is happening. And that often happens quite a lot in Elden Ring, actually.
So you're like, oh, thank you, finally someone's talking plainly.
Yes, yeah, basically. Like, it will kind of drop hints for a while, and then you might encounter someone that will kind of say, not super, super overtly, but they will explain kind of what's happening. But then you'll also... they'll kind of just stop talking. That's another thing with Souls. Like, they're not going to... there are multiple dialogue options. You can't just question them constantly, and they're not just going to give you, like, a dictionary's worth of information. They're just going to repeat exactly what they've said to you over and over.
Classic.
They leave you with questions, and they'll be answered at some point, at some stage. And if not, you're kind of left to fill the gaps in. Which I think is quite an interesting thing. Like, I'll just go watch like a YouTube video, probably. Maybe once I finish this game, I'll watch like a 2-hour deep dive into like the overarching story or a certain boss or something. And some of that will be probably sort of on point, but some of it will, it might not be. It might just be totally made up, like almost theory crafted or something. But I think that's kind of a cool part of Souls. I don't know.
Do you get any sense at all of the influence of George R. R. Martin, or has that basically been a bit of a marketing stunt?
Again, in all honesty, I'm not sort of playing this game and going, "God, there's George, there he is." Like, that's George, that's classic George with that classic line. It's maybe through kind of the fantasy world, sort of, not really, because I guess Souls has always kind of gone for the Western fantasy, sort of East Asian influences kind of thing that's been going on. So I'm rambling, but I'm trying to say is no, not really. Perhaps maybe a more overt Soul story, that it kind of feels like maybe there are less gaps to be filled by the community. Like, they are, some of the NPCs are more forthcoming with their strands of story, I suppose. So perhaps maybe that's where George has come in. Perhaps the story is maybe a bit more stitched together than past Souls, which do feel like sometimes they do just do that makes no sense. And this perhaps is yeah, I feel like glued together more tightly.
The big thing about the world in Elden Ring probably isn't that it's sprinkled with lore. Most people probably aren't even going to care about that too much. But the bigger thing is that it's an open world. So to put the storytelling to one side for a second, does that work for this kind of game? Like for a Souls-ish game?
Yeah, absolutely. I sort of banged on about it in my review to the point where I was like, oh God, have I just submitted something that is literally just talking about the open world? But I think it makes such a huge difference. I think it makes the game sort of far more approachable. I found in past sort of Souls games, they're often challenging to the point where they're sort of frustrating, and their worlds are open to an extent, but they're also largely quite linear. You find you're kind of going down corridors and tunnels a lot. They're quite sort of claustrophobic, I suppose. And when you come across a boss or an encounter, you kind of have to just butt your head against that. And if you can't do that, you just have to put down the controller and just walk off for a bit and come back. Whereas in Elden Ring, you might encounter, I don't know, a cave filled with goblins, which will want to tear you a new one. And if they do tear you a new one, you don't have to just butt your head against them until you do beat them. You can just go off and do something else and become stronger and wiser and come back to the goblins and take them on. And the way it's kind of sort of put together, things aren't far away. There's not a lot of barren ground before you bump into something.
So it's quite dense.
Yes. It's extremely dense. Almost kind of impossibly dense. like it sounds ridiculous. Honestly, there are times when I'm playing this game and thinking, like, how have they pulled this off? Because to do the dreaded comparison with Breath of the Wild, which I'm sure will upset a lot of people, I sort of found with that, I love that game, but I found there were times where you do have to kind of cross quite a lot of ground, and it's quite, you know, it's open. There's not a lot going on sometimes. That's fine. That's extremely chill. But with this, you won't probably go more than a minute or two before you are just stumbling into a doorway that's hidden in some like nook, or you look to one side and there's this vista with a castle on like a rock in the middle of the ocean and some way of getting there. And it's just amazing how that those things will then just lead to almost classic Souls. So you've kind of got this open world and you can traverse it on this horse and you can jog around. And I guess that is more like the open world Elden Ring experience, I suppose. But then sort of offshoots of that, there are like just loads of offshoots or like branches that you can go into and they'll transport you to a more classic sort of claustrophobic Souls experience, if that makes sense. So it can kind of, you'll go into a doorway and you'll go from kind of like a greenish, grayish kind of ruined town kind of atmosphere to suddenly, you know, you creak those doors open like you do in a Souls game with that like amazing animation. I love it. You push them open, the lights will kind of dim and you'll get that, I don't know what font it is. It's not Comic Sans, but it's...
I'd love a Souls game with Comic Sans in it.
But we'll just pretend it's Comic Sans for the comedic element, and it will say, like, you are in Derek's lair.
I can see this.
Yeah.
I think If You Died was in Comic Sans. The best. Yeah. I gotta say, the game is out today as we're recording this. You're making it very difficult for me to go back to work after we finish recording.
I'm so sorry.
You mentioned that you're picking fruit. Is crafting something that shows up here, like in other open world games? Like, am I gonna need to skin 10 beavers to make a bigger coin pouch or souls pouch or any of that?
There is item crafting in this, and it works in quite a simplistic way. So say I'm out in Elden Ring's world and there'll be some bushes with some red berries on them, and it's essentially you just wander up to them, you press a button and they'll just kind of get hoovered into your inventory. There's kind of no animation or anything, they just kind of get picked and they get chucked
just
into
the classic pick up things in Dark Souls experience.
Yeah, just like it's extremely kind of like chill. there's like wildlife that roams around the open world, like turtles. There are lots of turtles in Elden Ring, and like there's like eagles and goats, and you can leave them and they'll be nice and they won't attack you, or you can be merciless and just chop them down and they'll give you feathers or meat or thin animal bones and things like that, which you can then use to craft I don't know, like little pellets for your horse that'll heal him back up, or throwing knives and things like that. I will say that sort of the option to craft isn't super obvious. Like, you have to buy you have to buy a crafting kit from a particular merchant early on, and you can just miss that in classic Souls fashion. So if you don't pick up this crafting kit, then you'll be locked out of crafting for like the entire game, which is really silly. But I wouldn't say that crafting is like tied that heavily to quests or you know, to beat certain bosses and things. It's kind of just an optional thing that you can do if you'd like, which I quite like. It's quite relaxed. I never feel pressured to stay skin 10 beavers for Jeff, the merchant over there, to get something, you know.
The quest lines for recurring characters in Souls games, they're a little borked usually.
Yeah.
Like, they sometimes would require a guide to even understand them. It's very hard to intuitively get how someone's quest works in Dark Souls 3, for example. You just sort of end up clicking yes or no, you agree to things, or you give them stuff and see what happens. Are things different in Elden Ring? Are they like a little more clear, or...
I would say, again, yes and no. I suppose my yes component is that they are perhaps a little bit more overt. Like, a lot of them will kind of say, I'm looking for an item, like a golden fleece that I have lost. Could you... They will actually just ask you, like, could you go and fetch me this from that castle that is over to the south? And you can say accept and great, that's good. But I'd say my no component is, you can bring them back this fleece, and they'll be like, thank you so much for that. And then they'll kind of just, they might reward you. They might say, I'm going to go back to my homeland, or I'll see you back here. But it's then kind of up to you to go and revisit them. And sometimes they won't even say anything. They'll kind of just stand there, and it's kind of, you can just miss them, I suppose. They're always often tucked away in some kind of optional area, and so far I haven't managed to miss too many interactions. But there is this nagging part of me which says that there has been some NPC that I haven't maybe fulfilled their request, or perhaps I haven't initiated conversation with them that one time that I should have, or something. And that's the thing, like, Elden Ring won't, it trusts you to kind of to visit these characters and almost take your own notes on things that you've been given. But I think there's another element where there's a place called the Round Table Hold that kind of acts as your hub zone, a bit like in Bloodborne or in Dark Souls you had Firelink Shrine, which I guess some of your kind of homies would chill out. Some NPCs from Elden Ring, like you'll meet, will go back to Round Table Hold. So it kind of, in some ways, there's almost less chance of missing some of the more important characters, because Elden Ring will kind of catch those for you in its like own bug net way and kind of fling them into the Round Table Hold. So you can't possibly miss them, if that kind of makes sense.
It sounds like very similar to what previous Dark Souls games do.
Yes, yeah.
Where NPCs will basically like telewarp somewhere and you won't know where necessarily, but you'll spot them on an off chance and you'll go, oh, you're here.
It also kind of, it does that thing where you don't know whether you've completed a quest line. Like, you don't know whether that's the mission complete, I suppose.
Yeah.
And you might then just suddenly see them. 30, 40 hours later, and all of a sudden they'll become some horrible tentacled being that wants to kill you or want to help you. But
and you're sitting there like, who are you again?
That's it. I can see it now. There's someone I've encountered in Elden Ring that kind of their quest line sort of came to quite an abrupt halt, and they kind of just said like, oh no, so and so has, you know, something's happened to so and so, and then that was it. They kind of just would like leave me alone now. So I don't know like what I meant to have done there. Should I have consoled them somehow by dropping an item next to them? Do I just wander off and leave them be? Like, it's, again, it just reiterates kind of how obtuse it can be, and I think it can be a little bit frustrating. But
this does feel like John was telling us how you can do a lot of world building, but ultimately it's only one element of storytelling. You've got to pull the reader in with the stories, like, of the people or the things that are going on in that world. And it sounds like Elden Ring's, like, the greater world building around it is interesting. Like, the limbs thing is quite intriguing, and I guess some NPCs might say things that are, like, you know, piquing your interest, but the stories that are threaded through it have a hard time keeping up with them.
Yeah, I think so. Like, it is, sometimes it's hard when people and objects and whatever you're doing, I guess they're just not, sometimes they're assuming a lot of knowledge. They're just, I guess it sort of embeds you in their world, I guess, because you're almost one of them, and they're just chatting to you as if, you know, you're their mate sometimes. But at the same time, because there's so much kind of assumed knowledge, and you're just this dude who's turned up in the lands between, you don't know what's going on. And me, the player who is playing the dude who's just arrived in the lands between, like, I'm part of this. I'm part of this world. I'm not part of, like, I don't live in this realm with limbs and horrible. Like, I don't pick fruit.
I don't live in the lands between.
Exactly. So yeah, that's it. It can be just quite overwhelming sometimes, I suppose.
That is almost something that Souls fans like, you know.
Yeah.
They enjoy this method of trying to peel apart the story, and the people who don't even care about the story like it because it's non-invasive. In your review, you said that it was very encouraging. It was an encouraging game, which is not necessarily a word that comes immediately to mind when thinking of Souls games.
Yeah.
But you must have a reason to say it's encouraging. So what's your thinking there?
I think it's kind of, it's encouraging because, well, it's encouraging in its own sort of non-encouraging way, which that's extremely...
Okay.
So
okay.
I think it's kind of, I guess going back to my previous point where, say I've got a friend and we're playing like Dark Souls or Bloodborne, and we're both down the pub and we're kind of saying to each other, like, we're both 5 hours in, we've never played it before, where are you at? And both of us may arrive at the same point. We'll probably say we're at Vicar Amelia or whatever. And that's that, because Bloodborne is a fairly linear game. Whereas in Elden Ring, I could be chatting with my mate and we could both be 5 hours in, and my mate could be at a boss and I could just be in that cavern over there fighting a Trojan horse made out of like ooze or something. And I suppose what I'm trying to get at is the game encourages you to explore by giving you this open world. Like, it's just giving you so many different options, and of those options, they're all wanting to kill you. None of them are particularly friendly, but you have a buffet as opposed to like a, I don't know, like a 5-course meal where you have to just eat your food and deal with it. This time you can pick and choose what
it's
you
like
want.
Serve yourself, get up and shovel the things under your plate.
Yeah.
A hotel breakfast buffet.
Yeah. I love a hotel.
The best kind of dinner.
Yeah, that's it. So I suppose it's kind of, I'm trying to sort of say that it's encouraging in kind of a horrible, painful way, because those things that you can go out and do may be really tricky, but it will guide you to some extent with the graces, which act as kind of the bonfires, and they will kind of steer you with the breeze. They'll leave like this trail, and that'll take you towards like the main story path, I suppose, of kind of like the big bosses and the big sort of bigger story elements. But it's kind of, as I said in my review, it's kind of where the wispy trails aren't going, that is almost the game in its own hidden, veiled, horrible way, encouraging you to go against that grain and to go like, hey, the trail's pointing that way, but what would happen perhaps if you were to go the other way, or to take your time and explore a little bit more and level up and fight some other things before going on to this main story beat. So yeah, I suppose that's where I'm trying to come from in this encouraging, the encouraging aspect.
No, I think I get it. I think I get it. All right. That's all we have time for, I'm afraid. You've been listening to Hey Lassen with me, Brendan, and Ed Thorne. Thank you very much for joining us, Ed.
Thank you.
I'll link to your review, of course, but if anyone wants to find you on the internet, if they've enjoyed your thoughts on the game, where can people find you?
You can find me on Rock Paper Shotgun, just under the author Ed Thorne, or I don't tweet, but I'm on Twitter, at From Edward.
If you've enjoyed this episode, listeners, please consider supporting us. Throw a dollar or two in our tin at Patreon. If you become a regular donor, you get extra goodies, including access to the full interviews, like I said. We also might get bonus episodes at a certain tier, like the bonus episode that Ed and I are about to record. We might talk more about Elden Ring, or we might not. We might talk about Vampire Survivors instead. I have to give a couple of shout-outs to some tip-top patrons. Shout out to Bok Choi, shout out to Horrendamonas, and shout out to Milk is Gross and Bad for You. They are the true builders of my world. Oh god. I'll come up with a good line about my supporters someday. Thank you very much for listening, as always, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.
Now, go forth.